Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Saving the economy versus saving lives. That is a simplistic, false choice. It represents nothing more than a complete failure of imagination, a failure to recognize that we do not have to choose one over the other. Well, now that the Trump administration has recommended that physical distancing measures stay in place through the end of April, there is room now to ask a much better question. In an ethical society, how do we best unwind from a lockdown? What are the moral values and the economic and policy tools we should be using to get the economy back on track? Because, yes, eventually decisions will have to be made. However, it's not about balancing lives against an economic system, because that system is us. It is all of us. So this hour on Point, we're going to have a conversation with an economist and an ethicist about how values and policy should come together to restart the economy. And joining us to have this conversation is Christine Mitchell. She's executive director of the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School. She founded the ethics program at Boston's Children's Hospital and led their ethics advisory committee for 30 years. She joins us today from Boston, Massachusetts. Christine Mitchell, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Hi.
It's great to have you. And also with us is Andrew Atkinson. Sorry, Atkinson. I'm going to say that right, Andy, I promise. He's a professor of economics and finance at UCLA and a consultant to the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis as well. So, Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Hello. And the name is a misspelling. So the Atkinson name is generally closely related to me. If you find anyone with it.
Okay, great. Atkinson.
Yes.
Okay, good. I promise I'll do my best not to be tongue-tied throughout this entire hour with both of you. Now, listen, first of all, I do want to have this sort of better, wiser conversation, but I wanted to just get your reactions from both of you about, you know, over the past week or so, the fact that this question of saving the economy versus saving lives even popped up. So let's just listen briefly to one of the clearest articulations of this false dichotomy. It came from the lieutenant governor of the state of Texas, Dan Patrick. And back on March 23rd, he made these comments to Tucker Carlson on Fox News.
I'm not living in fear of COVID-19. What I'm living in fear of is what's happening to this country. And, you know, Tucker, no one reached out to me and said, as a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all America loves for your children and grandchildren? And if that's the exchange, I'm all in.
That's Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor of Texas, on March 23rd. Christine, first to you. I mean, what did you make of the fact that this question was even raised in the way it was across the United States?
I was surprised, too, at the way it was raised. I think that either way, you know, we can't trade off ruining the economy to save millions of lives against reviving the economy by sacrificing millions of lives, because those aren't the only things in play. Either way, even, you know, following Dan Patrick's preference, which I hope we don't do and we don't seem to be doing, there is bound to be a global economic recession. Even if we didn't do the kinds of physical distancing that are now being adopted, you know, not only in our country, but in other countries around the world, there are still going to be millions of deaths in the United States, Europe, Asia, India, Central and South America, and so on. And that will depress the economies around the world.
Mm. And Andy, your thoughts?
So as I've learned more about how epidemics work, I've been studying quickly, as many economists have in the last couple of weeks. Something that I saw was that, you know, I saw this as a false choice not just on ethical grounds, but also on practical grounds. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe helpful to go to the work of John Barry about what happened in 1918-19 when the Spanish flu came through and killed about 650,000 Americans over the course of, you know, from the spring of 1918 through the spring of 1919. And what happened was once the disease really got going and the death rate, you know, really started to rise in, you know, cities and communities around the country, people were just scared. And so they wouldn't go to work, even if they were ordered to do so. And so I think that, you know, even putting aside the ethics, when you consider the practical reality that we may be facing in a few weeks, that people, you know, death will start touching each of our lives and fear will naturally keep us in our homes. And so I saw the proposal to lift lockdown as one of, well, let's kind of have a chaotic, spontaneous lockdown in a few weeks when everyone's panicked in their homes, as opposed to something that was, you know, perhaps orderly and well organized and might be effective in fighting the disease.
Right.
I mean, so I think.
Sorry, I just wanted to jump in there because the example of what we can learn from 1918, 1919 is absolutely fascinating because let's not forget, I mean, people weren't returning to work, say, to the shipyards, right, as you were saying, even as there was actually quite a high demand for those workers because they were supposed to be making tools and ships for a war that was still going on. And that still wasn't enough to get people to overcome their concern and fear to head back to work. So, I mean, point taken, we don't have the pressing need of an immediate sort of a hot military war to draw people back into the workplace.
And I've seen, I think it was 2 days ago, a new paper has come out from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, a working paper that looked across cities in the United States, you know, different cities during that epidemic a century ago, some followed more aggressive, you know, public health measures and held the death rate down, and others, you know, did not. A lot of the stuff was done locally. And they're finding evidence that in the cities that, you know, prioritized public health, the recovery actually was faster and employment was higher after the epidemic. So they're actually coming down on the side of saying that public health and economic recovery go hand in hand.
Right. So let me turn back to Christine on that, because I just wanted to, I definitely want to hear what you have to say. That again, this is sort of lays bare the falsity of that dichotomy, that it's the economy versus the public health. That one, the truth, one actually supports the other, does it not?
Yes, and Andy's points are very well taken. I mean, one of the things that happened in the 1918 flu pandemic is that the politicians and government officials and leaders at the time lied for quite a long time about the flu and denied that it was happening and tried to suppress the information about it. And that had a very high cost for the general population in terms of trust. And so as they began to learn more and see for themselves what was happening to people around them who were getting sick, they became so afraid that you couldn't mobilize the population in a way that helped the economy to recover more effectively, in addition to the fact that there was a war going on.
So, I mean, Christine, just we can sort of put our moral philosopher hats on here for a second. Is there a good model that we ought to be following, or a mental framework that would help us think through these economic questions in a moral way?
Well, I would put a very high priority on telling the truth, especially in a democracy like ours with a comparatively robust press, where a very important component of protecting both our lives and our economy is ensuring that people understand what's going on and what they can do to help make it possible to survive themselves, help the people around them continue to be healthy, and keep the economy functioning, albeit at this suppressed rate for a while, so that, you know, they are able to follow the strategies that leaders who are looking at the broad picture of the common good for the entire country can coordinate things in a way that enable us to get to opening up the freedoms we used to have and restoring our economic well-being.
Mm. Andy, did you want to respond to that?
Yes, I mean, I totally agree that, if you think about the bedrock of a market economy is that actually people are voluntarily engaged in all the activities of work and shopping and providing for each other. And for that, you need a level of trust and faith in social order, and that when social order breaks down out of fear or panic, you know, the economy grinds to a halt. And so I think, you know, clear messages from political leaders and experts as to what's going on and what are the choices we face and where do we think we should head. I think those are critical to helping people psychologically prepare themselves for what's coming and to react to it in a way that doesn't lead to panic, but, you know, has kind of purpose and direction.
Mm. But as the weeks and maybe even months continue on, I think people are going to want to also hear from leaders about sort of how are they thinking through what the best way is to unwind from a lockdown. We've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a break, but just to be clear, Andy, about one thing, it's not like a switch. It's not just like on or off. We can actually selectively return parts of the economy to fuller functioning, can we not?
Maybe I should take this up after the break.
Okay.
I want to kind of lay out what I see as the options. And then we can discuss that.
Okay, well, let's do that then. So we are talking this hour about how to think with an ethicist and an economist about the best way to unwind from a lockdown and how to best do that in an ethical society. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're asking today how, in an ethical society, we best unwind from an economic lockdown in a way that benefits us all. And we're joined today by Christine Mitchell. She's Executive Director of the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School. And Andrew Atkinson joins us as well. He's a professor of economics and finance at the University of California, Los Angeles. And I just want to play a bit of tape here from a week ago Monday. And this is New York Governor Andrew Cuomo at his press briefing on that day. And he actually talked about, yes, I mean, New York is being very hard hit by coronavirus right now. And he said there actually needs to be two parallel tracks moving forward together that take into account both public health and economic viability.
I take total responsibility for shutting off the economy in terms of essential workers. But we also have to start to plan the pivot back to economic functionality, right? You can't stop the economy forever.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. So, Andy Atkinson, we were asking about, it doesn't have to be like a switch that gets flipped on or off, right? It's either lockdown or not, that we can actually think about this in more sophisticated ways. So where would we begin? For example, what is the information we need to make the best decisions on what areas of the economy we might want to bring more fully back online?
Okay, so, I mean, I think as a precondition for starting the economy or even parts of the economy, you have to be able to assure people that if they go back to work or if they go out to shop, they're not going to die. So you're going to have to know what is the danger, you know, from going back out and meeting people, which basically means you're going to have to know how prevalent is the disease at any moment in time. Mm-hmm. And we don't have good information about that. So as a practical matter, my understanding is we have, you say, three routes to get to that situation. One is what I would call what they've done in China, which is they pursued a very aggressive period of, you know, controls, public health measures to bring down infection rates. And they're now lifting the controls. But they're left in a situation, since we don't have a vaccine, that, you know, over time, this may come back. It may reappear in China just organically, or it may be brought in if people travel from other countries to China. So they're going to be living with the fear that this will come back and they might have to reimpose controls essentially over and over until we get a vaccine. Another route that at least in the UK, they were considering until recently, was you go for what's called herd immunity. You just let the disease go, and you go through this period of a lot of illness and potentially a lot of death. But you get to the point then that if enough of the population has had the disease, then you're resistant naturally. And at that point, people could go, the survivors, I would say, could go back to work. And then we have perhaps in the middle a route where we have moderate mitigation to keep the transmission of the disease at a relatively low level. It's still growing, but not very fast. And we hope we can kind of get through this with the end game being a vaccine, say in 18 months or 2 years. And I would say that's a model that appears to be followed in South Korea or Japan at this time.
So, Christine, let me turn to you. It sounds like what Andy is saying is that really right now it's impossible to make the best kinds of decisions without fundamental data still about this pandemic.
That is so very true. But I would add one other possible strategy to Andy's three. And, you know, his three being, you know, a kind of what Ed Yong called a protracted game of whack-a-mole, where you stamp down outbreaks and contain hotspots, each one as they come up. And his second one being herd immunity, and his third one being this moderate mitigation. I would add, you know, if we could actually join with partners around the world in a kind of cooperative control across borders and nations to keep track of who's doing what and where the mitigation is and isn't successful, so mm-hmm. that we can manage borders more effectively and travel more effectively without shutting everything down in most places.
Yeah. So cooperation, data, information, these are sort of fundamentals in terms of how we then figure out the best next steps to take. But Christine, also help me explore something else as well, because it seems like given the urgency of the moment that we're in, of course, there's a lot of focus right around this question of deaths and the economy. But if we're in a sort of a longer haul here, I think, right? It's safe to say no matter what, we're in a longer haul. So if we're thinking about impacts and costs that we must take under consideration for the long haul, how do we think about the impacts of on people's health and well-being of being out of work for a long time, perhaps because of this pandemic, or the housing insecurity, the food insecurity they might face. These are also both economic, health, and social costs as well that we have to somehow account for.
Absolutely, and they are essential for human flourishing. I mean, obviously, health is a good that you have to have in order to enjoy other goods, but these are all components of having a life worth living. One of the things that worries me is that roughly one out of every five people in the United States has lost working hours, so some income, or their job. And, you know, so because we've got hotels empty and flights canceled and restaurants closed and all the non-essential businesses closed, what we're seeing is that the world keeps chugging along basically on the work of people who are paid minimum wage or less. And some of them at, you know, pretty significant risk as they check hundreds of people through grocery stores and so forth. So I'm expecting to see social inequalities and especially economic inequalities widen as people with the lowest incomes are the hardest hit. And then, you know, one thing I'm anticipating, and I think others are beginning to worry about too, is a sort of secondary pandemic of mental health problems as people have increased anxiety, OCD, agoraphobia, the loneliness and despair of isolation, you know, the kind of discriminatory labeling and racism that, you know, is encouraged by some, increases in domestic violence and child abuse, not to mention the just exhaustion and burnout of some of our hardworking healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are going to be these things that we have to take into account as we restructure post-lockdown.
Right. So, Christine, in a previous interview, you put it rather beautifully. You called it a modification of the utilitarian approach, right? Trying to maximize lives saved while also protecting the most vulnerable as well. So, I mean, Andy, how do we achieve that modified utilitarian approach through an economist lens?
Well, I have to say it's extremely hard to forecast that. I mean, this is an event that I anticipate will change our political discussions along lots of dimensions that are, you know, hard to forecast now. I mean, for example, we just started the new spring quarter at UCLA on Monday. And so the last 2 days I've been teaching by Zoom, and the primary, and I, on top of that, I have a college-age son and two kids just out of college. The young are locked up at the cusp of adulthood, and you know this is difficult for them. So how are they going to react? How are they going to feel about those of us who are a bit older? You know, that's a dimension of a political debate. Christine already mentioned those who work, you know, where they actually have to face the customer or each other and thus be at risk of getting the disease versus those of us who can work from our homes and do things, you know, by Zoom or, you know, over the internet. That's another divide that I think will get quite stark. I'm sure there'll be other divides that we can't really anticipate. I saw something this morning that the flight attendants, you know, who are obviously customer facing on the airlines or lobbying to change how we're bailing out the airlines to make sure that they don't get fired. There'll be all kinds of, you know, fault lines, I think, politically that will end up reshaping kind of what we focus on with public policy going forward.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems to me, though, that these fault lines are made, we risk making them ever deeper if we don't have what both you and Christine have been underscoring, which is the good data so that we can actually make much more granular decisions. We don't have to have these like draconian blanket policies across tens or hundreds of millions of people. I mean, you could imagine a future, hopefully, where if we get that good data, you could say, well, it might just be this neighborhood or this one particular city that needs to stay with physical distancing for a little while longer. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, we could actually be more nimble in our policy response.
Yeah. So that's something that all the economists I talked to have woken up to. Something that's startling about the evolution of epidemics at the start. I mean, I guess it's a crash course in exponential growth. But what's startling is how little, if you have what you think is a small amount of uncertainty about some of the parameters of the evolution of the disease, you have end up having massive uncertainty about what's going on according to the models. So you'll see, you know, forecasts that we could have 200,000 deaths. You'll see forecasts that we could have 2 million deaths. And a natural person will ask, you know, can't these people get their story straight? Like, you know, which is it? But the way to think about it is the models make, you know, the uncertainty is over percentages. It's in logarithmic terms. So if you go back and say, I have uncertainty whether the initial number of cases in mid-January that flew into the United States from other countries was, say, 20 or 200. That seems like, yeah, it's pretty easy that we could have had 20 people come in from abroad with the disease. We could have had 200 people from abroad come into the disease. But that's an uncertainty in logarithmic terms of a factor of 10.
Mm-hmm.
So then that just translates when you go to things like, you know, deaths or whatever, or how many cases are there, that says, oh, it could be 200,000 or 2 million. And the only way to resolve that is to do large-scale randomized testing.
Right.
I understand in Germany, they're going to launch a program, or they're trying to do it quickly, of testing 100,000 people for antibodies to the disease so that they'll try to get a picture of how many people have been exposed to the disease. This type of data is absolutely critical to making, you know, informed decisions about which course of action we should choose, because there's still a lot of uncertainty about how deadly this disease is.
Right. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Now, Christine, about that uncertainty, I think
I'd love to follow up.
Yeah, go ahead.
To Andy.
Please go
ahead. You know, one of the things I think about is the difference is, not that I have a good grasp of this, but the apparent differences in the ethos of different nations. And so in the United States, we're well known, even in Europe, for having a high priority on individual autonomy and, you know, the kind of thing that, you know, even expressed in the current administration as kind of an America first attitude. And yet in some other places, there might be a little bit more of a national ethos that tends toward chipping in and protecting the common good with some degree of expected kind of normal sacrifice. So, for example, some countries gave government dollars to employers, to companies and institutions to ensure that they kept people employed and paid their salaries, even if they weren't actually working in the company or the institution. In the United States, we took the route of individual unemployment insurance and cash supplements to individuals. Do you see differences between, and do you think there's a good solid economic reasoning for the kind of approach we took, other than just that it fits our kind of national ethos?
So I think that was driven by practical considerations. So, you know, for better or worse, we're facing this crisis with the kind of the bureaucratic systems or the administrative systems that we have in place. So what you pointed to, Christine, is, you know, for instance, in some European countries where they have a kind of a nationwide, essentially a nationwide or federal unemployment system, I think Germany is an important one. they had already set up the mechanisms after the crisis, or actually during the crisis of 2008, to do exactly what you said. They would go to firms and they would say, essentially, we will pay you to keep your employees on the books. Yeah. And they, you know, they go home. We don't want them to spread the disease, but we're right. going to keep them employed. And the whole purpose of that, you know, it's expensive to hire new employees. You lose a lot when you break the relationship between an employer and employee. And similarly, particularly with many small businesses, you know, they have startup costs. And if you end up closing a lot of small businesses, you end up wasting all those startup costs. Now, in the United States, I mean, I have a colleague, Till von Wachter, who's been pushing for this. And I understand some of this was in the, you know, the bill that was recently passed. I think something 30 states, I probably have the number wrong, but maybe a little more than half the states in the United States have an opportunity for using furlough as part of the unemployment system. And so for some places in the United States, we're going to be able to follow a similar policy of essentially using financial incentives to encourage firms to, you know, maintain links with their employees, even if they're furloughed.
Mm. And well, let me just jump in here and just because we've got to take a quick break, Andy and Christine. But your point taken about some states, but not all yet in the United States. So we'll be right back in about a minute. We're talking about smarter ways to think through how in an ethical society we unwind from a lockdown. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how in an ethical society, we would best unwind from a lockdown. We're trying to get away from that false dichotomy about saving the economy versus saving lives. And to help us do that, I'm joined today by Christine Mitchell. She's executive director of the Center for Bioethics at Harvard Medical School. And Andy Atkinson also joins us. He's a professor of economics and finance at the University of California, Los Angeles. And let's quickly go to our callers. David's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. David, you're on the air.
Thank you. I think that there's no question that the Trump administration put the economy well in front of lives. When you consider that South Korea and the U.S. had their first known cases at the same time, the South Korean response was immediate. The Trump administration downplayed it as a hoax, and then it's going to be 15 deaths and it's going to go away. So 2 months later, they start taking it seriously, and I think that that's why we're in the boat that we are in. And one thing I would add to that is that the lack of transparency, they're telling us, you know, don't worry about masks. They're not really effective, and yet they're freaking out about the frontliners having masks. Mm. Asian countries will tell you masks work.
Mm. Well,
just don't have them. And I'm sorry, and I'm a cancer survivor, recent. And I called my oncologist to get a test, and he said, there are no tests in Oklahoma. And they keep saying, oh, anybody that wants one can get one. There are no tests here.
Wow. Well, David, thank you so much for that call. And on the point of the federal government's response, let's go quickly now to Jerry, who's calling from Simsbury, Connecticut. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I sort of look at this thing as anybody who's been paying attention either for years or for months knew this was coming towards us. Maybe not C-19 particularly, but something like this was coming. And we had time to think about things to do. Right now, I'm going to use like a technical term. Our society is in a hard restart. We couldn't just shut down the program. We've shut down the entire machine. When we bring the machine back up, we should think about ways to bring it back up that we've been saying we couldn't do for years.
Yeah.
I'm an educator. For decades, people have said high school should start later. It said that our school system should be organized differently, but everybody says, well, you can't change all of society to make schools be more logical and helpful. Well, now we can.
Mm-hmm.
When school districts come back, when places come back, these are the things that we need to think about. We're seeing right now that the kids who have higher need, who don't have the technology to be able to do this distance learning that we want to have happen in the future. So I think it behooves us to really look at this hard restart and to say, okay, let's not worry about just getting everything back to the way it was.
Right. Hey, Jerry, can I take it back from you there? Because I think you're making a really, really strong point, and I want to hear from both Christine and Andy about this. So, Christine, let me start with you. Because picking up where Jerry said, like, we shouldn't be just thinking about how to get back to the way it was. And I want to follow up on that, because I keep coming back to this idea that just thinking about things through a purely economic lens or about, like, just returning to the status quo is a failure of imagination. That is the phrase that's keep popping up in my head over and over and over again for the past week. And so, for example, when we frame it like getting back to the status quo, we're not even looking at really important parts of the solution, such as we flatten the curve, right, we should also be trying to raise the bar in terms of the capacity of the healthcare system, right? And here's why I ask it, because we're not seeing enough push or leadership from the federal government on assisting the healthcare system right now. I mean, I was just hearing just today, we've got governors saying, while they want to buy more ventilators, they're being outbid by FEMA, right? Or that, the Defense Production Act hasn't been fully, it's been invoked, but not fully applied in the way that it could, so that part of the economic solution is actually helping the healthcare system right now. But we're not really doing that to the best of our abilities.
Yeah, that is unfortunately true. I mean, perhaps they are leading from behind, but it's not that helpful. I mean, and it's not just the president and the administration, although that is conspicuous and that is severely ineffective. But, you know, under the what-if scenarios of emergency preparedness, the Global Health Security Index ranked the United States, even before this pandemic, as the most prepared. The United States was number one with a score of 83.5 in the world in, you know, being evaluated for preparedness, strength, resources, resilience in the healthcare system and related institutions. And we have fallen so far short of that. It's beyond embarrassing. We could not do containment because we didn't have adequate testing and we didn't cooperate to ensure that there would be functional, effective testing, and we couldn't do contact tracing. And so we ended up having to do this kind of lockdown mitigation that was a kind of second resort. So Jerry's right. We should take the opportunity to make something better out of this hard restart. And, you know, I have some ideas about that, but, you know, I'm not in charge.
Well, Andy, let me hear from you about this idea that, you know, more creative thinking in terms of what the economy means might include more proactive and aggressive supports for the healthcare system right now in this emergency phase of dealing with the pandemic.
I totally agree that the mobilization of resources, to the critical areas in the healthcare system, you know, I don't see that happening. Bill Gates just wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post today echoing that point, and he's much more expert on that than I am. I think that we are falling short in that dimension. But I do want to say something about this idea of reimagining kind of how we do things as we go forward. And perhaps you should seek out a guest with humanities experience on this or historical experience on this question. There is a question of why is it that, you know, as students in school, we didn't really learn about the 1918-1919 pandemic. You don't see much literature on that. You don't see much art that came out of that experience. This is something David Brooks wrote about in the New York Times a few weeks ago, that there seems to be, the country got through that pandemic 100 years ago, and then nobody wanted to talk about it. It's as if it never happened. I knew a lot of people who didn't know that it happened. They know World War I, they know the Roaring Twenties, they know the Great Depression, but that sort of got left off. And David Brooks speculated that as people went through the difficulties of fear and breakdown of social order, it became something they didn't want to remember. And it was a decision to sort of have collective amnesia. And that may happen here. And I agree that that may then lead to a lost opportunity for coming out with a constructive plan.
Interesting. Well, we actually last week we did an hour taking a close look at that 1918 pandemic with John Barry, in fact, Andy. And so, folks, if you want to listen to that, go to onpointradio.org. Now, let me ask you both, to our caller's point about a hard restart, I think we should explore a little bit about a hard restart from what exactly? Because this is a moment for all of us as a nation to hold a mirror up, isn't it? Because I think to myself, we felt this sense of shock that anyone would even dare say, sacrifice lives for the sake of the economy. Like, it felt like a moral shock. But honestly, as I thought about it, the truth is that in the United States, before the pandemic, we were making decisions every day that sacrificed people's lives for the economy, right? Christy, I'm thinking this is a nation that was okay with having tens of millions of people without health care. This is a nation that is okay with 40% of children living either in poverty or on the brink of poverty. So we are definitely making decisions that are having negative impacts on people's lives for the sake of this number, like the GDP or unemployment rate. That is who we are. If we are cruel in this moment in asking a question about lives versus the economy, it's because we already were.
Yeah, definitely a time for moral imagination. When you think about the way in which Vietnam and the protest against it and the civil rights era imprinted itself on my generation, or World War II imprinted itself on the generation before us, or more recently in memory, 9/11, changed the ways we thought about our world and led to a focus on counterterrorism that has occupied us ever since. This is a COVID generation, and it may, in fact, with the right imagination and leaders in place, lead to a focus on public health. We're already seeing Anthony Fauci socks online that you can buy, or donuts with his picture on it, and people are starting to think about science and beginning to turn away from the kind of idea that science doesn't matter. So maybe it will turn out that this imprint on the global psyche will lead to a shift in how we think about labor practices, about access to health care for all, because we're all in this together, to social changes that have to do with working from home and not coming in when you're sick. Finding new ways of coming together and pivoting from a kind of social isolationism, kind of nationally, to more international cooperation, just as happened after World War II, when there was a tension on, international human rights and a world court and so forth. So this is a moment where moral imagination can, in fact, have an influence.
Andy, I know you want to jump in here. Go ahead.
I want to ask a bit of a provocative question because I'm wrestling with this myself. So let's imagine that we conducted a widespread testing program along the lines of what they're doing in Germany and in the next few weeks, we found out or we got reliable data that say maybe 150 million Americans had already been exposed to the virus. Mm-hmm. And imagine that we calculated that if we got to 220 million Americans exposed, then we would have herd immunity. At that point, if those were the numbers in, say, 2 or 3 weeks, I can imagine people saying, maybe we should lift lockdown and just go for it, go for herd immunity. And that would obviously involve, you know, some loss of life. But there's a, you know, that would be a scenario in which the fatality rate of the disease would be substantially lower than the 1% that's being used in many models. And that would be the kind of trade-off we might face, you know, as data comes in.
Well, so let me answer. I'll offer you just my quick sort of layperson's answer to your provocative question, if I could. I should probably let Christine take this, but I'm going to do it anyway. First of all, that means we would have that data, which would be great. It would put us more ahead of where we are now. And second of all, does it have to be a trade-off, Andy? Because could we imagine a situation where if we knew that 150 million people had already been exposed and perhaps therefore had at least immunity amongst that 150 million, is there a policy scenario, an economic one, where some of those people are allowed to return to work safely in a way that doesn't increase the threat to the Americans who are still vulnerable?
Well, so my understanding of this is that there's two kinds of threats. There's the threat that, you know, by overloading the healthcare system with a burst of illness, that we, you know, dramatically exacerbate the death rate from the disease just yes. because people can't get medical care. But then there's the, you know, let's put that concern aside or say we've managed somehow to get the capacity up that we can handle it. That obviously would take a lot, and that's a big if. Then there's just like the fundamental aspect of the disease that if you have like a constant death rate, the cumulative number of deaths you're going to have is just how many people do you end up ever having the infection once you get to herd immunity. And so whether you go slowly or go quickly, you know, putting aside this issue of overloading the healthcare system, you're pretty much ending up with the same number of deaths.
I mean, Christine, though, is that true? Because if the healthcare system isn't overloaded, ostensibly you can save more lives.
Yes, you could. It tries to put COVID into the same category as the way we tolerate deaths from seasonal flu. But, you know, I don't want to be a Debbie Downer here, but I do want to say this is a novel coronavirus, and we still don't know how long immunity lasts. So, you know, I am all for herd immunity, and if we have a vaccine, you know, that will help. But we haven't understood this particular coronavirus well enough yet to know that we can rely on herd immunity for a long period of time.
Mm, okay. Well, we've got about a minute and a half-ish left here. And I have one last question for both of you. And Christine, I'll start with you just briefly. Again, we're really interested in helping provide listeners with some tools on how to think through these big questions that we're all facing with now. So what's one tool you would say or an idea that you think people ought to use to help them understand this question of the economy, about an ethical society and how to unwind from a lockdown?
Well, you know, I think the do unto others as you would have them do unto you is not the perfect moral rule, but it is a rule we should take more seriously in terms of thinking about our neighbors and ensuring that we all contribute to a society in which we and the most vulnerable among us are protected. You know, and I think we're getting there. You know, people mm-hmm. are beginning to realize that, quote, we're all in this together. If I had a coin for every time I've heard that said or said it myself, I could build a nice little nest egg, or better yet, I could give a sizable donation to somebody who needs it to pay the rent or yeah. buy food or get a computer for their children who are going to school right. remotely. But we are all in this together. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to think about our neighbors yeah. as well as ourselves.
Well, Andy, I'm going to give you a couple of seconds here. Do you have a final thought for us?
Yeah. So, you know, this disease is turning the logic of Adam Smith on its head. The invisible hand being good for the, you know, society doesn't work here, because going out to shop or work, you know, infects people and kills them. And so people should think in terms of everything I thought about a market economy yeah. temporarily is on pause.
Well, Andy Atkinson at UCLA and Christine Mitchell at Harvard Medical School, thank you both so much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.